I'll admit that we had to start this over because I was coughing and sneezing and could not find my words. How you doing?
What else is new? I'm all right. I had some ice cream, so I'm feeling better.
Some really good chocolate truffle ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we made our donation. That's pretty exciting.
We did make our donation. Thank you, everyone, for sharing and listening and supporting.
Really, really appreciate it. And I feel like you have a good story. You've been pretty excited to tell this story.
That's not true. It's only what I said in our first very boring opening. But I kind of am actually excited to tell my story, even though I know everyone is dying to hear how your story ends. But my story, I thought I knew what had happened to someone. And then when I looked into it, there was a few different theories and it actually totally changed my mind about something. So I'm kind of excited to see if I'm going to change your mind.
Dun, dun, dun. Change your mind?
Mm-hmm.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Okay.
But real quick.
Yeah.
Give us a recap. Last week.
Oh, you're asking a lot of me. It's been a whole week.
Well, last week, so everyone was pretty much dead.
There's a recap in my story.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Let's try to help you out.
Yeah, the kids are okay.
Kids are okay.
Wait, wait, wait. If you haven't, spoiler alert, if you haven't listened to part one, make sure to do that
right
now. Turn it off. But if you have, then yeah, the kids are okay. The mm-hmm. mom is okay. Everybody else, 82 people, are dead.
Oh, so creepy. Okay.
Okay. So, July 17th, 1998, the spot where the Windsor apartments once stood now belonged to a mid-sized office complex called Anderson Office Co-op. Construction had been started in early 1997 and continued after roughly about a year. At this point, midsummer 98, 9 of the 10 floors were completed and 32 of the 40 office suites were occupied. There were some medical companies, primarily dental. There were also both B2B and B2C sales companies, an optometrist on the first floor, and a handful of software startups, including an online gaming company that never really amounted to anything, but I still think it's pretty cool.
Are you saying B2B and B2C to feel cool? Do you think people know what that means?
People know what that means.
Okay.
Breakfast to bed.
Ooh.
When you take breakfast to bed, that's
B2B.
When you take breakfast to the couch, that's B2C.
Oh, I knew it as business to business. It's more professional
okay.
terms.
Okay.
But okay, we'll go with your thing.
So there's a breakfast to bed company.
We're having B2B tonight then.
Yeah, we are.
That was a little creepy.
So the apartment massacre of 1979 was all but forgotten. It had been concealed or pushed aside or simply let go, depending on who you ask. There had been a huge bidding war over the property, which resulted in several years of nothing happening.
Why would you want that property?
I mean, they were gentrifying the neighborhood at the time. Remember, that was one of the theories about what could have happened, is that it was this...
I'm just surprised that, that building wasn't torn down.
The original apartment complex was torn down.
Oh.
This was to rebuild a new office
in the spot
complex.
Where it was.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. I'm with you now.
So there was a huge bidding war. Nothing happened for several years. But eventually, Adam Anderson won out and the Anderson Office Co-op was born. Nothing crazy happened. It wouldn't be the type of place you'd expect crazy to occur anyway. Just a series of gray skewed floors with fluorescent lights and drone-like workers. I assume I wasn't actually there.
Taking some liberties here, I feel like.
I hear, whatever. We don't need to get into it.
Uh-oh, no, tell us.
That is until July 17th. Macy, I am not going to say this name correctly, Cornicoli?
Ooh, I like Cornicoli.
All right, Macy Cornicoli, 28, was a copywriter for an advertising firm on the sixth floor that primarily worked on hygiene brands. She was tall, thin, and had red hair that was always tied up in a bun. She wasn't known as the kindest person in the office, but was very good at closing deals and made a lot of money. On July 17th at 11:42 a.m., Macy excused herself from a meeting to use the bathroom.
It was very precise.
They were, I think, they
she wrote it, "Dear diary, 11:42."
No, they keep the minutes for their meetings.
Oh, that makes so. More sense.
Smart Alec over
it's very
here.
Very detailed.
Yeah. Julie Finn, 24, is washing her hands and reports that Macy walked in, looked at herself in the mirror, and then pulled out a gold letter opener and jammed it through her own neck.
Oh, fuck.
Hitting an artery and bleeding out in a matter of minutes. Building security burst in and tried to stop the bleeding and restart Macy's heart, but it was too late. What they did find was a symbol burned on her stomach just inside the pelvic area. It was roughly the diameter of a soda can and matched the symbols painted in blood during the massacre of 1979. At this point, nobody was thinking that there might be a connection between the mass killing and Macy's death. After all, it was a clear suicide and had a witness. Then, on August 1st, 1998, Thomas Wilkins, 52, a VP at Herman Medical Supplies, hurled himself out his eighth-story window while in the middle of a conference call. His lower body hit a parked car below, and the speed of his descent snapped his spine upon impact and caused his ribcage to protrude through his chest. A small burn symbol was found over his heart. At this point, people were starting to get concerned that there was a gas leak or something that was causing a deadly psychosis and eliciting these untimely deaths. Experts were brought in between August 9th and August 14th, but nothing was found to be leaking or contaminated or anything like that. As the two victims were from different companies, authorities eventually chalked it up to a sad coincidence. Then came August 25th. Donald Douglas, 37, a retired Navy veteran and current sales associate at Kingman Office Co., reported to his boss, Diane Cook, 48, that he thought he heard something trapped in the vents while in the men's bathroom.
Nope.
Diane, I mean, if you're in the men's bathroom and you just hear some grumbling, it's probably not the vents.
Ew. Oh,
took you a minute.
I feel like that was unnecessary. <Took you>. Gross.
Sorry, not a time for jokes. Diane called security and a search was conducted. Don't ask me how.
How?
I don't know. But no one was ever found. Over the next week, Douglas reported hearing the same voice three more times. He finally stopped saying it was in the bathroom, though, and was now saying that the voices were following him around the building.
Well, that's not great.
On September 14th, 1998, Douglas attempted to crawl into the ventilation shaft to prove that there was somebody inside. He ended up falling more than 80 feet and breaking his neck. Though the autopsy showed that he did not die right away, but lie trapped in an inverted position for 15 hours passing away. His throat was raw from screaming, and there was a small burned symbol on the heel of his foot. At this point, conspiracy theorists and paranormal believers began coming out of the woodwork. They caused such a commotion that police were forced to step in, and the courts issued restraining orders against several groups, making them stay a minimum of 50 feet away from the building. Jack Flipson, 42, a former Virginia State Police sergeant and current private investigator, was then hired by a well-funded conspiracy theorist named Donald Kitt, who went by the moniker The Truth. Yeah, not super original. Flipson began to investigate a possible link between the recent suicides and the mass killing of 79. Sadly, it had been so long and so many of the records had been destroyed that it made his job more than difficult. Eventually, he found himself talking to the only survivors of the massacre, Mary Buckley, now 48, and her children, Belle, 29, and David, 23. They were all living in California. Mary was still in the medical field, Belle was a baking apprentice, and David was in college for his master's in psychology. Mary and her kids were reluctant to speak with Flipson about the massacre and went so far as to apply for a restraining order against him as well, but they dropped it after David looked into the deaths at the Anderson Co-op and convinced his family to hear the investigator out. Mary told them everything, essentially detailing what we heard in part one of the story. David and Belle recounted how Bethy, a short older woman with a bent back, had saved their lives by hiding them in a water tank on the roof. Unfortunately, Bethy didn't make it out alive and was among the 82 dead in the original killing. Flipson, however, didn't recognize the name Bethy or Elizabeth. There was only one Elizabeth in the apartment records at the time, and her last name was Connors, not Monsino, as Bethy's had been. Connors was also 24 and accounted for in the dead. Flipson ended up going through some photos of the dead and eventually found a woman named Sarah Conchi, who Mary recognized as Bethy. Flipson returned to Virginia. It was now November 12, 1998, and two more people had died by suicide from the office co-op, both bearing the burn mark. Police were now saying that there was a cult that was forcing its members to off themselves and urging the public to report any info they had. Nothing came in. Flipson brought Sarah Conchie's name back to Donnell, his client, and together they looked into the woman, eventually finding unsubstantiated evidence that she was the head of a major crime ring. There had been rumors of a drug and prostitution operation going on within the Windsor apartments, but nothing had been recovered after the massacre, suggesting it was true. Now, it's important to note that Flipson was not a believer in curses or the paranormal or anything of that nature. So when Donnell asked him to sneak into the office complex to see if he could gather video or audio evidence of something unworldly, he saw it as easy money. When he came out, he was reportedly stark white and had quite a different view on the afterlife. Flipson said he made it until 3 a.m. before getting tired and finding a couch on the fifth floor to sleep. He awoke approximately 30 minutes later, hearing a soft cry for help. He said he followed it into the men's bathroom and... Are you ready for this?
Ready.
Because it gets weird. You've been very silent.
There's just like a lot of names going on. I'm trying to keep everything straight.
Okay. He reports kneeling next to the vent, and the cries then ceased. As he stood up, he noticed that he had no reflection in the mirror at all. He approached the mirror, thinking his mind was playing tricks on him. He reached for the light switch on the wall to better see, but they wouldn't turn on. When he looked back, he saw the face of a young, emaciated man where his should be. He said he saw the man had no eyes, and his expression was twisted as if screaming, though no sound was coming out. Flipson bolted into the hallway and back to the couch to grab the camera, not sure what he saw in the moment but wanting to capture it on film. As he raced back into the bathroom, he reported feeling a cold breeze creeping up behind him as if keeping pace. He said it got stronger and stronger until he arrived at the bathroom door, but it wouldn't open. Flipson then says he felt someone breathing on the back of his neck, but when he turned around, no one was there. He pressed the elevator button and got in, trying to leave. Flipson was terrified at this point and just wanting to get the hell out of the building, but on the descent, he says he felt something pushing on him, forcing him to the ground, then felt something hot on his arm like a burning. At the ground floor, the doors didn't open, or so he says. But he was able to pry them apart and bolt toward the exit. It was nearly 4:15 a.m. when he left the building. 3 days later, he stepped in front of a bus. Flipson's death inspired a lot more interest, as he was a former cop and a well-respected PI. In fact, it's probably the only reason the original massacre case was reopened. While it's still not solved, the following facts were discovered. Sarah Conchie was the head of the Conchie family, a major crime cartel in the Virginia area specializing in drugs and prostitution. Rent payments for 29 units were traced back to her organization in one way or another. Authorities now suspect that she oversaw an operation that may have worked through the walls of the units to move, package, and sell large quantities of drugs, as well as women as young as 14. This can't be confirmed, obviously, as the building was shut down, but through photos you can see objects like couches and paintings, etc., placed by the wall in the same areas across several units. They think there may have been hidden doors there. So, the leading theory is that the massacre was a hit from a rival crime family who were ordered to take out everyone in the building because they didn't know who worked for the Conchies and who didn't. They think the symbols drawn on the walls in blood was a means of throwing off the investigation. That said, many still believe that authorities are wrong, as there's a man named Joe Conchie, a cousin of Sarah's, who was committed to an asylum in upstate New York in the early 70s. Records show that he was convinced a demon haunted the Conchie family and that it was going to send, get this, animals to devour them all. In case you don't remember, the killers in 1979 all wore Muppet masks. And what are Muppets? Animals.
Yeah, but...
except Skeeter and Scooter. I don't know what they were. Gosh. Or Gonzo, actually. I don't know what he was
Let's
either.
Let's not get into the politics of what is and is not a Muppet.
To this day, conspiracy theorists and believers are sure that either some otherworldly entities committed those heinous crimes, or that they were men who were contracted through devil worshiping and told to commit the acts as animals. Sounds crazy, but what's even less explainable is why so many people took their own lives in the Anderson Office Co-op, and why they all had a cryptic symbol burned into their skin. I feel like I was talking in a very high voice that entire time.
That's your normal voice.
Like Mickey Mouse?
What are you talking about?
What are you talking about?
Hey, guys!
That's a lot. That was a lot of information.
Well, that's why I broke it up into two stories. There was no way I was going to do that. It's just one. But
well, what do you think? Is that building still there today? Do you know?
The office co-op?
Yeah.
I think so. I don't know if it's still...
It'd be interesting to know if anything has happened since. You know what I mean? What would make... If something was there, what would make it all suddenly stop?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I have no idea. That's where all of the stories that I read ended. All the research I was able to do. So I'm assuming nothing else has happened since then. But I don't know. It's a weird occurrence. But I'll tell you, the thing that got me for this story was the guy in the ventilation shaft who was stuck upside down.
That's rough.
For 15 hours. Nope.
No. Oh, you don't want to do that?
I opt out of that. Yeah. So I don't know.
Also, it seems like they're taking, that chick was like, oh, she came in here and stabbed herself in the neck. That chick could have killed her just as easily, stabbed her in the neck. She's the only witness.
Oh, damn. I didn't even think about
That's only one incident.
She was behind
still,
the whole thing.
But you know what I mean? Like, they're just like, yep, that's probably it. She probably killed herself.
I mean, I'm sure. I mean, the woman who was suicidal, her fingerprints were on the weapon and not the woman who just witnessed it. But I suppose that could have been concocted,
too. She could just have stabbed her. And then I feel like if I was stabbed in the neck, I would immediately grab the thing that was in my neck. I don't know why I'm really focused on this.
No, that's okay. Yeah. All right.
Of all the things that happened, I want to talk about the killer in the bathroom.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. The story started so long ago that I'm sure certain parts have been embellished. And like I said, there is something like a conspiracy or whatever. So take what you will from it. But creepy, creepy shit.
Yeah, man. Those kids, well, they're not kids now.
No, those kids, I'm surprised they weren't notes about how messed up they were.
Yeah.
But, I mean, maybe they didn't see a lot of it, you know? You don't know if they were just brought up there.
I mean, even the whole situation, I would be so traumatized. Like, God, it would be so terrible.
Well, hit us up with this mind-blasting story.
Mind-blasting?
It's a new thing I'm trying out.
It's a rough day today.
I mean, you've heard of like having your mind blown, but have you ever been had your mind blasted?
That was long. Yeah, we got it.
Okay.
Hey, that was funny. Good job.
I'm tired.
I feel like we're fading. Now that we've all found out what we wanted to know, I feel like we're all over it.
Okay.
Nobody cares about my story.
That's not true at all. I'm very interested in your story.
Do you want to know what it's about?
Yeah. I'd like to know the whole story.
Okay. This is, and there's a question mark at the end of this.
Okay.
The title, The Murder.
Was that word murder?
Murder of Van Gogh.
Is the question if it was Van Gogh who was murdered or
Van Gogh
was murdered?
Was Van Gogh murdered?
Okay. Because the way you put the emphasis on there, it's like the murder of Van Gogh.
Oh.
I don't know. Some guy.
Are you done?
Yeah.
Do you want to hear it or not?
Yeah.
Or you want to talk about how I say things, pronounce things?
No.
Okay.
Tell me about this guy. Who's Van Gogh?
Okay, so I got most of this from Wikipedia, obviously, and dailyartmagazine.com and littlevanityfair.com.
Ooh.
So here we go. Vincent Van Gogh was born on March 30th, of 1853 to upper middle class parents. As a child, Van Gogh was quiet and serious, and he was taught at home by his mother and a governess. But in 1864, he was sent to boarding school, leaving him feeling abandoned and begging to come home. However, instead of allowing him to come back, when the time came for middle school, he was just sent to another boarding school, leaving him feeling deeply unhappy. In July of 1869, his uncle secured a job for him at an art dealer, and after completing his training, he was transferred to a London branch. This may have been the happiest time in Van Gogh's life, as he was somewhat successful at his job and even earned more money than his father did. It was during this time that he became obsessed with his landlady's daughter, but she rejected him after he confessed his feelings for her. He started to grow more isolated. A transfer was arranged for him, but in 1875, a transfer was arranged in 1875, but just a year later, he was dismissed from his job. So we flash forward to 1881. Now 28 years old, Van Gogh takes up painting.
He didn't start till he was 28.
Yeah, it said he painted like as a child, but like as other children do. Nothing like he never showed an interest in it. He never actually did it.
That's
until much later in his life. He was supported financially by his younger brother, Theo, with whom he kept up correspondence with by letter. His early works lack the vivid colors he came to be known for. In 1886, Van Gogh moved to Paris and took a new approach to his paintings, incorporating more color into his work and developing his own painting style. It was during this time that he moved away from the still life paintings he was doing and started broadening his subject matter to include wheat fields, sunflowers, and olive trees. Van Gogh was plagued with psychotic episodes and delusions, but often neglected his health. He did not eat properly and drank excessively. His friendship with a man he had met in Paris ended one night after a confrontation that involved a razor in which he had severed part of his left ear while in a rage. The man claims that Van Gogh rushed toward him, razor in hand, and after the altercation, Van Gogh returned to his room where he began to hear voices. He severed his left ear either partially or in whole, accounts differ, bandaged the wound, wrapped the ear in paper, and brought it to a woman at a brothel that he and the friend both frequented. Van Gogh was found unconscious the next morning and taken to the hospital. The ear was also brought to the hospital, but as too much time had passed since it had been severed, no attempt was made to reattach it. Van Gogh could not remember the event at all and suggested he may have had a mental breakdown. Just a few days later, police ordered him to be placed in the care of a hospital. Van Gogh recovered and returned to his yellow house in 1889, but 3 months later, the police closed his house after 30 townspeople petitioned to have the, quote, red-headed madman removed. So Van Gogh went back to the hospital and then into an asylum where he stayed for about a year before moving closer to his brother, Theo. Just as a side note, did you know that Van Gogh did most of his famous paintings while in an institution?
I did know that, actually.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I did not know that it was a prostitute that he brought his ear to, though.
Really?
I thought it was like some woman
that's
that
like
he...
That's like the only thing people know about
Van
Gogh.
Well, I knew he gave it to a woman. I thought it was some woman that he had this undying
brothel,
adoration
yeah.
for. I get that.
I didn't go in...
If I had a dollar for every ear I've given of corn.
Okay. I didn't go. There's obviously so much information about Van Gogh, and I didn't yeah. want to talk about it all. I mean, he's a fascinating man. I wanted to just give enough. You'll understand why. But
yeah.
I think he probably went to this woman because his whole history with women is not great. It's time after time he tells these women he's so in love with them. He tries to make it work and he's always rejected.
That's rough.
So, I mean, the brothel, it's a sure thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now in 1890, Gaston, I don't know, and René, two 16-year-old students who were studying in Paris, arrived in the town that Van Gogh was living. The boy soon heard about Van Gogh, who would walk through town with his supplies, set up wherever he pleased, drink, and argue in a mix of Dutch and French. René was the son of a pharmacist, lived a swanky lifestyle, and soon became a piece of shit bully. His hero was Wild Bill Cody, and he even purchased a souvenir costume from the show the character was on.
What a nerd.
It featured fringed buckskin, chaps, and a cowboy hat.
Ugh.
And René took it a step further and accessorized it with a small caliber pistol that often misfired. René struck up some sort of weird friendship with Van Gogh. He'd pay for drinks for Van Gogh, but would then mock him to try to impress his friends. René shared his pornography collection with Van Gogh and even posed for some paintings and drawings, all while playing pranks on the artist. Him and his friends would salt Van Gogh's tea, put snakes in his paint box, and hot pepper on his brushes, as they knew the artist held the brushes in his mouth while deep in thought. Then came the fateful day, July 29th, 1890. Van Gogh stumbled into the inn where he was living, sometime after dark, clutching his stomach. The family that owned the inn asked if he was okay, as he seemed to be struggling to climb the stairs to his room. He responded with, quote, "I tried to kill myself," showing the owner a wound in his stomach. According to Van Gogh, he had gone out for the day to paint in a wheat field, and then during that afternoon, he had shot himself with a revolver and passed out. He was revived by the coolness of the night, tried to find the gun to finish the job, but couldn't, so he walked back to the inn. Van Gogh died slowly and painfully, finally succumbing to his injury 2 days later. This version of events is based on the testimony of the inn owner's daughter, who was just 13 at the time. She waited 53 years to speak on the record, and each time she told the story, it was slightly different. In the immediate days following the incident, no one mentioned the word suicide, but simply stated that the painter had wounded himself. No one knows where he would have gotten a gun, and no one has ever found the gun or any of the items he had taken with him to paint that day, including his easel and canvas. The professionals at his deathbed could not make sense of his wound, wondering why a person who was trying to kill himself would shoot himself in the midsection. Now, there was a long neglected account from a woman who lived in the same town. She claims that the items he had taken with him had never been found in the wheat field because he was never in the wheat field. She says she saw Van Gogh earlier that day on the road that led to the home of René and his family. René even publicly stated that Van Gogh had taken his revolver. In the 1930s, an art historian traveled to the town and interviewed people, and later, at least once while on the record, he said he kept hearing the same rumor that some, quote, young boys had accidentally shot Van Gogh, and that the men never came forward for fear of being charged with murder. On his deathbed, Van Gogh stated, "Do not accuse anyone. It is I who wanted to kill myself." Here he was, a man who loved writing letters, but did not have a suicide note. Instead, a draft of an optimistic letter to his brother was found in his pocket. Also interesting is the fact that René left town in the middle of the summer season. He claims to have gone before the incident, but many think it could have been that same day. He never received fame or recognition while alive, but as we all know, is famous for his paintings now and is considered to be your classic misunderstood genius.
Yeah, those kids fucking did it.
100%.
100%.
I always thought Van Gogh killed himself.
René, I did too. René said that he came and, like, that Van Gogh got the gun from him. And then he was saying he was out of town that day? It don't make sense,
that
René.
He just borrowed the gun, and he also... He was on record saying that gun was like notorious for misfiring, but I guess it didn't misfire that day, which makes me think they were playing a prank on him. He pointed the gun at him.
and it went off.
Thinking it was going to misfire, that it never worked, and then shot him in the stomach.
What fucking dicks.
What a dick.
Quick question for you. So you accidentally kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Do you...
All the time.
Those aren't accidents. do you come forward? Or do you... Are you afraid that you'll go to prison for life and it was an accident, so you take the win if you can?
I feel like it's one of those things where if you accidentally shoot someone... And you call for help right away, maybe.
You're still going to get manslaughter if they die.
Yeah, but then you're, I mean, this kid got lucky because it was back in the day. You can't do this today. You can't be like, I'm just going to leave and no one will ever know I was
no,
here.
No, of course, yeah.
So if this happened, if you're asking me if this happened today, I would of course call. I mean, maybe I can prove it was an accident, but. Otherwise, the only choice is now I'm disposing of a body and now it's far worse than it could have been.
Well, but are you disposing of a body? Because Van Gogh went back and was, I mean, he was suicidal anyway.
So are you saying in this exact situation, or are you asking me if I accidentally kill someone?
No, just in, I guess in any, but yeah,
I would love
I think it's
to
an
believe
interesting...
that I would call someone right away.
I mean, the movie Very Bad Things comes to mind where they accidentally... kill a prostitute and then they are panicked that they don't want to get caught, so they dispose of the body and they
have to live with that for the rest of their
well,
lives.
That's what I'm asking is could you
don't
I couldn't
hit her,
do that
stab her neck on the
it's
thing.
like a door hook thing.
Yeah.
Not like one of those little plastic
no,
3M
I
ones. The ones at my
They're
house
strong.
That just keep coming off the, with your towel on it. But yeah, that's the thing. For me, I feel guilty like if I don't put my weights away at the gym. There's no way.
That's what I mean. You have to live the rest of your life, which this kid has done. I 100% believe he... I do think it was probably an accident, but I do
sure,
think he was
yeah.
being a dick and pointing a gun at him.
Absolutely.
But he's lived his whole life with no problem being like, nope, wasn't me. Didn't kill him.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand
that's the
how
thing,
people
is
can
if you're
do
put,
that.
If you're put in a situation where it's either you go to jail or you learn to fucking deal with it, do you think you would go to jail or learn to deal with it?
I hope I could, I don't know, go to jail. It's, I don't know. I feel like that is something that just... You can maybe push it to the back of your mind for a few years, but over time that has to just eat away at you.
I mean, it's a telltale heart, right? You love Poe.
It's getting too deep.
Too deep? All right. Well, good story. I didn't
but
know
I had
that.
Never, I didn't know all of that.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely. I think that those kids did it.
But it's so, I mean, it's so shitty just because he lived this sad, like, solitary life. People were like, oh, yep. Killed himself. But I think it's so interesting if you do kill yourself, why, as you're dying, why would you be like, don't blame anyone, this was me? He's just like trying to, I don't know, I'm sad, like trying to protect these kids, but also wanting to die. I don't know.
Well, there was a just really real quick story. I watched a documentary on internet killers on Hulu. And there was this guy in the UK who would meet gentlemen over Grindr or some other app, and he would kill them, and he would leave, like, on one of them he left a note saying, don't blame the guy I was with last night. It wasn't him. I'm like,
I shouldn't laugh
because
that's so
that,
terrible,
but that's the thing, as soon
on.
As you see that, or as soon as somebody says that, it's like, no, yeah, it was
100%
that guy.
You, bro. 100%. I didn't think it was you, but now I know it was you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like if you walk into the room and I'm there with like chocolate all over my face, like I didn't eat a chocolate bar. I don't know what happened.
Pretty frequently.
Yeah, it does. And you never fall for it.
Never.
You're always like, you ate it.
But, well.
Okay, well, good story.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I really appreciate your story. That was a good one.
You appreciate my story?
No, I do. That was good as... Something I'd never heard of, and
oh, good.
Now I know a little bit more about Van Gogh.
And a sad, sad life.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do love that he created so many beautiful works of art from an institution while trying to get help, and it's just like an insight of what was going on in his mind, and I think he's so fascinating, and it's all very sad, but anyway.
Okay.
Go ahead and share this one, guys.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for listening. SOTWpodcast.com.
All day.
All right. Sweet dreams.
Good night.
Oh, I said that backward.
God damn it.
Good night.
You just mouthed it to me. Is it me? Is it my turn? I said yes.
Good night.
Sweet fucking dreams.